you gonna do?
Drop it, it's written all over your face, don't stop it, just drop it, more like it's hotness, kicking the dough with the fofo, messing with Joe, now this chick got a ass similar to Mike Jones, say my name enough, then I'm taking you home, you know I walk with I talk with I sleep with the chrome, one squeezing your gum.
Quest Keto is making the ketogenic lifestyle more delicious and more convenient than ever. The high-fat, moderate-protein, low-carb keto diet has earned a reputation for being complicated. Quest Keto has changed all of that by offering sweet and savory snacks and an entire line of ready-to-go ketogenic meals. They've taken the guesswork out of it for you. From keto cinnamon rolls, pizza, crackers, and more, you can enjoy it all and experience the benefits of this nutritious approach anytime, anywhere. Thanks to Quest Keto. Go to QuestKeto.com to order your meals today.
The following paid program does not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of the staff and management of Tricepter Productions or the Superhuman Channel. Tricepter Productions and the Superhuman Channel are not responsible for any claims, warranties, or guarantees made during this program.
Prepare to experience the strongest radio allowable by law. Secrets will be revealed. Myths dispelled.
From the studio gym where excuses never apply.
It's Superhuman Radio with your host, Carl Lenore.
You know, I get excited to do this job because it is an exciting job to get here and sit and talk to people who are really brilliant. And I love people because of their brains and their minds. And this next guy is one of those guys. I've wanted to have Daniel Orego on this show for a long time, and it's finally happening. So this is exciting. How you doing, Daniel?
Not too bad, my man. I wish I could be there with you in the studio, but this will work.
Yes, absolutely. Daniel's on the West Coast, and I'm pretty close to the East Coast. Daniel Orego is the Vice President of the Epigenetics Foundation, an organization that is working tirelessly to find the linkage between disease states and nutrition so that those disease states can be eradicated, or better yet, avoided completely when we understand the role of nutrition in these disease states. And really, Epigenetics Foundation's main focus at this point in time is cancer, correct?
Yeah, that's accurate. I mean, we really look at therapeutics and performance is really, you know, opposite sides of the same coin. And what's intriguing about that is that oftentimes what you find to be efficacious as a nutritional therapy oftentimes has performance implications and vice versa. So it's great because we can kind of tackle those two domains concurrently and get the benefit of that approach.
Now, just to kind of, for those people who are not familiar with Epigenetics Foundation and some of the great work that it's done, I kind of would like to just maybe do a brief review of what you folks have done, say, for instance, with the Keto Pet Sanctuary.
Yeah. We've got a few projects, obviously, that are focused on cancer. Probably the one that's maybe by this point better known is our Keto Pet Sanctuary project. And basically what we did there was to try to understand in the real world the impact that a ketogenic diet could have on canine cancers. And we approached that by essentially trying to accomplish two things at the same time. One was to rescue dogs who have cancer that would otherwise be euthanized. As you may know, there's kill shelters out there, and if a dog has a lump or a bump, they'll probably get put down. So we were able to work with the shelters to rescue those dogs from those environments. But the other piece of that was to apply a ketogenic diet, really referencing the same protocols that were used in glioblastoma or human brain cancer, and apply those to dogs. And to kind of jump to the punchline on that, what we saw through the use of PET CT scans or positron emission tomography and computerized tomography is that we could see that, yes, okay, this nutritional protocol does have legs. And when the tumor load is very low, oftentimes you can see a reversal in that tumor load. If the tumor burden is higher, you really don't get those results, but you do observe an interesting phenomenon, which is you see that metastatic progression or progression of the disease is oftentimes slowed or in the best cases, halted. So that program continues to try to understand, okay, how far can a nutritional intervention go? And more broadly, how far can metabolic interventions go? And what I mean by that is that in the human world, there's all kinds of metabolic interventions with human cancer that are just starting to come to the fore. You know, you and I have talked before about the properties of metformin, which is a very old diabetic drug. It's now being understood to be very efficacious as a way of mitigating disease progression in cancer. In fact, one of the more interesting discoveries recently is that a very popular and efficacious chemotherapeutic, Gleevec, is now understood to be composed of effectively Crestor or Lipitor, which is a statin, and fenformin, which is an analog of metformin.
Right.
So what was thought to essentially attack the genetic basis of various cancers is now understood to do so through a metabolic pathway now that those chemical structures of that drug is known. So there's a whole landscape there, and the dogs are one component of that, obviously, but we're also very interested in brain cancer. We wrapped a pilot study last year at Cedars-Sinai where we basically looked at the same thing in a human model. To what degree can a ketogenic diet impact glioblastoma, astrocytoma, oligodendrogliomas, these various brain cancers? And we saw a very similar set of results in a very dynamic environment because obviously these were controlled studies. But what they did show us is that we were getting results in those brain cancer patients which were unanticipated by the oncologist, the neuro-oncologist that were that were taking care of them. And so that was something that obviously very favorable, and also led us to look at the things that we're very focused on now, which is early cancer detection.
So with that being said, the project with Cedars-Sinai is extremely exciting from the standpoint of there are a growing number of people who are denying standard of care. There's a growing number of people who go, there's got to be another way besides chemo and radiation. And brain cancer produces a very unique opportunity because this is one area of cancer where I would say the oncology segment has kind of doesn't have an answer. Ionizing radiation quite often makes these tumors grow faster. And chemo doesn't get through the blood-brain barrier. So most of these people are relegated to go home and die. And so when you come in and say, hey, we'd like to try something, they kind of go, well, you're not threatening anything we're doing because we don't have an answer for that. Go ahead and do it. And there are a large number of people now that are actually saying, I don't want chemo. I don't want radiation. Isn't there something else? And that provides a unique opportunity for Epygenix, doesn't it?
It really does. And you've kind of keyed on, I think, where the opportunity is, right? Using nutrition as an adjuvant to standard of care, or in cases where either the patient is past standard of care, in other words, they've tried it and it's failed, or they said, hey, look, I don't want to go down that path, offers what's becoming, I think, a more and more viable alternative. And I think where that picture starts to open up a little bit is as you build this inventory of case studies, as you build this inventory of anecdotal testimonials, if you will, that starts to, help establishment medicine focus on these other areas, which are really outside of the standard of care. But I think you said it best. It doesn't threaten what they're doing. And to any degree it helps, only moves them forward. So those are some of the advantages.
Okay, so obviously there's people out there going, yeah, I don't have cancer. I don't know anybody who has cancer. You know, this is not interesting to me. But cancer is just a very important target, but there are a host of diseases, everything from neurological demyelination type diseases. We're seeing now metabolic linkages to multiple sclerosis, to Parkinson's disease. And you know, it's like, oh my, it actually makes your head spin because when you start to look at the implications of the microbiome, the food that we feed our bugs, and the progression of diseases, including rheumatoid arthritis and autoimmune disorders, all of a sudden you go, wait a minute, this isn't just about cancer, is it?
Well, right. I think you're spot on there. And really, when you look at nutrition, nutrition is kind of like the thin edge of the wedge to have a much larger conversation about controlling metabolism, what the long-term effects of that are, both from a disease perspective and a performance perspective, right? You know, athletes who train very hard and who have high expectations for performance, you know, whether they're football players or track athletes or what have you, use nutrition to get a performance effect. So they're effectively manipulating their metabolism to get an outcome on the field or an outcome on game day or when they perform. I think that same strategy, that same approach can be applied to disease and essentially the mitigation of disease, right? I think there's a fair amount of consensus around the fact that whether you're a medical professional or a layperson, that nutrition is probably pretty important. The challenge gets in is, okay, well, what do I do about that? How do I use nutrition to control my metabolism? And that's where the conversation gets really interesting, right? And the landscape of choice is enormous. Yes. Because there's different choices that you can make for different health outcomes or different performance outcomes.
Well, and one of the things that I love about you is actually something that I also love about Adele Moussa. And that is, no pun intended, because of Keto Pets, you really don't have any dog in any particular fight other than the pursuit of the obvious truth of things. And with that being said, you're not somebody who says this is what you need. You like to look at things from a standpoint of what are your goals? And then let's right. find the nutritional protocol that fits your goal. You're not a no carb guy. I know I've eaten with you. I mean, you're not a guy, oh, no, carbs are evil. It really depends on what your goals are, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's actually a fair characterization. In terms of, I really like to work backwards from the outcome. You know, I think there's a famous quote, so I think maybe it was Stephen Covey who said, begin with the end in mind, right? And so, you know, the landscape of variety in terms of, you know, what people want, whether it's from a performance outcome or a health outcome, man, it's huge. It's colossal. And so I think keying in on what the goal set is the first step to coming up with not only an efficacious and comprehensive solution, but something that you can know in advance is at least tracking towards the goal set. Granted, you may need to make some adjustments and things like that along the way, but I think that gives you the biggest advantage in terms of a point of departure and how to approach these things.
Okay, so with that being said, you, to you, this is not dogma. This is about results, and the results varies. So one of the things that I have tried to do on this show, I didn't like put it right out there, but I've mentioned it whenever I've had an opportunity. And I want to talk about fiber sources for a second.
Sure.
Quest did something very benevolent. And unlike most companies, they didn't go, hey, we're doing this. You know, everybody wants credit for everything today. Hey, look, I'm eating my meal today the right way, you know. And Quest did something very benevolent. They discovered, with goal in mind, right? So Quest produces engineered foods with specific goals in mind, right? And with that goal in mind, I think it was Jacob Wilson who did a nice study on different fiber sources. And what he had discovered was that some fiber sources don't act like fiber per se. They act more like sugars. And that caused Quest to quietly and internally review what they were doing with their bar, make a radical change that literally cost them tens of millions of dollars and change their fiber source. A lot of people through that process were upset. Oh, the bar changed flavors and blah, blah, blah. But Quest stayed true to the mission and came out the other end with, again, a delicious bar, but with a different fiber source that no one else, to my knowledge, is using today. Talk about the differences in fiber and why Quest did what they did.
Sure. I mean, actually, you bring up kind of a great a case study, which is probably a good exemplar of a commercial institution actually following the science. And What you're describing is essentially an analysis of the differences, the metabolic differences between IMO, isomaltose oligosaccharide, and SCF, soluble corn fiber, right? So as you're aware, oftentimes these fibers are used as carriers or fillers in foods, right? In the case of the bars that you're describing, the fiber is used as a carrier for protein. It also contributes towards some of the organoleptic properties of the bar, how soft, chewy the bar is, things like that. And what's interesting in this case is that what was discovered was that the fiber that was being used, the isomaltose oligosaccharide, the IMO, was in fact not a fiber. And this was something that was prior to not known. And the reason for that is actually kind of fascinating, because fibers are tested against enzyme profiles, specifically buccal or mouth enzymes and pancreatic enzymes. And in the case of IMO, it quote-unquote counts as a fiber by that assessment because it resists both buccal or mouth and pancreatic enzymes. But what was discovered is that it doesn't resist the enzymes in the brush border of the intestine. And so, in fact, those that quote-unquote fiber, the IMO, was being consumed as a carbohydrate and therefore had, in fact, a metabolic impact of raising blood sugars and insulin slightly. Now, it should be said that even though IMO is a carbohydrate, it is a low glycemic load carbohydrate. And so the choice to move to the SCF or soluble corn fiber in that instance was driven by the desire to ensure that the carrier that was being used for the bolus of, you know, 20 or 21 grams of protein did not raise insulin, and most importantly, was insulin mediating. What I mean by that is, you know, as you know, prebiotic fibers, because they're resistant, are butyrate producing in the lower gut and therefore modulate insulin down. So this was actually the metabolic outcome that the bar was designed to produce, right? Two things. One, it will deliver a bolus of, you know, 20 grams or so of protein and do so without raising insulin and blood sugar. And so the switch from IMO or isomaltose oligosaccharide to the soluble corn fiber was done precisely in the way that you described. In other words, it was in keeping with the mission. In other words, the intended metabolic outcome that the bar was designed to produce. And so, you know, this actually brings up some interesting questions that go beyond protein bars per se, which is this is in fact the same landscape of choice that anyone who wants to control metabolism has to make. They have to know what the metabolic effect is of the constituents that they're consuming are, and make those choices as informed consumers, and ultimately make those choices pursuant to the outcomes they're trying to achieve.
So when I said to you, well, you know, these are not real fibers, and you said, well, no, they are. And in fact, depending on your goal, they are good choices. For instance, you said if you were an athlete getting ready to actually engage in athletic performance, well, then IMO may be good for you because it's going to actually contribute to some of the glucose in your blood.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually a fair point, right? So for somebody who is, say, like a triathlete or a track runner or, you know, somebody who's doing CrossFit, using IMO could confer a benefit that is favorable for that endeavor. On the flip side, if someone is trying to put on muscle while at the same time lose fat,
right,
then controlling insulin is a big part of producing that effect. And so raising insulin, which is, you know, as we know, is a storage hormone, may not be the metabolic outcome they want. And therefore, the inclusion of a soluble corn fiber is much more favorable for that endeavor.
So when something says it has a certain percentage of fiber, I guess the takeaway from this discussion is for people to understand how that fiber will act in their body. And in some cases, I must point out something, and I stand to be corrected, but another popular fiber today is from chicory root, and it's called inulin. And that fiber actually has the ability to convert to fructose through hydrolysis. So if you take inulin in dry powder and add it to, and I'll pick something. There's a popular kefir out there that actually adds inulin, so that has fiber. If you add inulin to something that has water in it, it actually turns to fructose in solution on the shelf. So this idea that fiber is not true. Now, people shouldn't go running crazy about this, but understand that if you want a fiber that's going to go in your mouth as fiber and come out the other end as fiber, that is going to be the soluble corn fiber that you folks use. If you want one that's going to actually contribute to some substrate, then maybe IMO or inulin is a good choice for you.
Precisely. And, you know, you bring up an interesting point because, you know, the fact that certain constituents can transform over time and change their macronutrient profile is oftentimes one of those nuances that sometimes can be lost on a consumer. So, you know, arming someone with those facts helps them to make a better choice in terms of, like, you know, how they're applying their dollars, importantly, but even more importantly is how they can control their metabolism to get the benefit that they're looking for.
Okay. We're going to take a quick commercial break. And when we come back, I want to talk about this new and exciting sugar called allulose. Everyone's talking about it, but I want to talk to you about it because I know that you were really on the front end of its utilization. And I want to know the whole story about it. I don't know the whole story about allulose. So here's what I want to do. We're going to take one quick commercial break. We're going to pay a few bills. And when we come back, we'll rejoin the discussion with Daniel Arrego. Stay tuned. We shall return. If I can find the right mouse, I have three computers, two mice, and I don't know which one to hit first. I'm producing radio and TV at the same time here. AnabolicMinds.com is the premier website for credible information on building muscle, burning fat, supplementation, and more. With over 100,000 active registered members and over 2.5 million posts, it's one of the largest communities on the internet to get help and answers to your questions. It's also the place that the official Superhuman Radio Forum is hosted. Visit AnabolicMinds.com today and get into the action. AnabolicMinds.com. Learn. Teach. Lead.
Eat dessert again with the new 100% natural line of high-protein, low-carb Quest protein bars. I love lemon cream pie and strawberry cheesecake, but you can choose from chocolate peanut butter, coconut cashew, or cinnamon roll as well. No matter which one you try, you'll feel like you're eating dessert. But this is no ordinary dessert. With 20 grams of high-quality whey protein isolate, 17 grams of prebiotic fiber, and sweetened with stevia, these bars will make you feel like you're cheating, but you're not. Go to superhumanradio.com. And click the Quest Protein Bar banner ad to learn more about these clean and delicious protein bars.
Hey, this is Carl. Start your day just like I do with a high-dose lipospheric vitamin C from Livon Labs. You too can benefit from Livon Labs' lipospheric delivery system. No more pills or powders. That's outdated technology. Livon Labs has the world's most efficient vitamin delivery system, period. Learn a lot more today at livonlabs.com and benefit from their new reduced pricing. That's liveonlabs.com, L-I-V-O-N, labs.com.
Discover the faster way of getting real results with bodybuildingsupplements.com. Bodybuildingsupplements.com has powerful, proven solutions like patent technology, Crealkaline Supreme, Mass Pro Synthogen, and Adaptogen N.
RVD here. I love Adaptogen N. Give it a try. You'll see.
Buy Adaptogen N at bodybuildingsupplements.com. See remarkable results in 21 days or your money back. Bodybuildingsupplements.com. Since 1993, the trusted source for real results.
Use promo code SUPERHUMAN and get an extra 15% off your Adaptogen N today at bodybuildingsupplements.com.
In today's world, what would you give to have that ultimate edge, to always function at the highest possible level? That's exactly what the Da Vinci from Ultra Human gives you. Just one tablet a day increases focus, lowers anxiety, enhances social fluency, and improves your mood and drive. It's 8 hours strong with no crash. A sharp mind is priceless. And the Da Vinci even comes with a money-back guarantee. Find out more at theultrahuman.net. Make your brain 25 again with the Da Vinci from theultrahuman.net. Use discount code SHR10 for 10% off and free shipping.
Do you know how to properly use carbohydrates to ignite your performance in the field and in the gym? You will now, thanks to this free book by EFX Sports. The Carb User's Guide for Maximum Performance reveals why omitting carbohydrates from your diet can totally crush your gains. Ever wonder how many grams you need for your specific sport? Not anymore. We give you the critical number you need to dominate your competition. You'll even discover the super carb that's taking the athletic world by storm. You must try it to believe it. Go to getcarbolin.com/carb guide today and get your copy absolutely free. Once again, it's getcarbolin.com/carbguide.
Hey, this is Carl. I want to remind you of the importance of electrolytes because of all the workout supplements on the market today. I think electrolytes are the most important but the most overlooked. Check out the new Jigsaw Electrolyte Supreme. It contains a broad spectrum of electrolytes plus a few extra minerals and vitamins. The lemon-lime flavor tastes great, and it comes in single-serving packets that make it easy for you to take on the go. Visit superhumanradio.com and click the Jigsaw Electrolyte Supreme banner ad today and save 10% off your purchase.
This is the Superhuman Channel, where we use oxygen for the power of good.
Welcome back. We're talking with Daniel Orego. He is vice president of the Epigenics Foundation. When I tell people about epigenics, I often either am met with one of two looks on their face. The first one is they're incredulous. How could that be? How could they be working on these things? How could there be a metabolic link to disease? Wouldn't my doctor tell me about that? That's sometimes I get that. And then the other times, they want to know more about it. They want to go to a website. They want to learn more about it. It's never in the middle. It's never like, let me think about it. But it's amazing. What epigenics is doing is really amazing and doing it quite effectively. And I congratulate you for that. Before we talk about allulose, Victoria Adelis said, woot, woot, allulose is awesome. So that's up on the screen right now. Thanks for listening live, Victoria. So tell us about allulose. How did it – you guys are on the cutting edge of engineered nutrition. There's no doubt about that. It really is an amazing phenomenon. Quest Nutrition is the Microsoft and Apple of nutrition combined. How did allulose get on your radar? Give me the story.
Sure. So, you know, what's interesting about I think what Quest pursues in this regard is that there's quite a process of discovery, or in this case with allulose, uncovering. Something that's actually is not new. Allulose is actually the trade name for D-cycose. So D-cycose or allulose has been around as a sweetener for probably about like 50 years, Carl. And one of the reasons why I think it's relatively unknown, here in the States is because the best research, comes out of Japan. And it's used as a sweetener in Japan and Korea and China and places like that. And it's actually a sugar, in fact, a rare sugar, that's derived in very minute quantities from say like a fig or a raisin. But it has some incredibly unique and favorable properties. Not the least of which, you know, as you know, a standard carbohydrate is 4 calories per gram. Allulose is 0.4. Calories per gram. In fact, it's probably between 0.2 and 0.4 calories per gram. And so, it's nearly acaloric. Additionally, it has zero metabolic impact. So it passes through one system completely undigested. And so this gives you essentially a sugar that has the same organoleptic properties as say a dextrose, right, or a table sugar, a cane sugar. In other words, in terms of mouthfeel, in terms of that graininess, it's about 80% or so as sweet as a table sugar, but has no impact on insulin or blood sugars whatsoever. The other piece to this, and this is really more from a food industry perspective. It also happens to be a natural sweetener. So there's a lot of people out there who prefer not to use an aspartame or a sucralose and would gravitate more towards, say, an erythritol or a stevia, but find that erythritol and stevia actually aren't perfect analogs for that sugar taste. And that's where sort of allulose threads the needle. It's a natural sugar, nearly acaloric, has zero metabolic impact, but yet tastes like a regular sugar. So those properties sort of make it a little bit of the golden child. And, you know, what's interesting is you can actually go, you know, on Amazon right now and buy allulose either, I think, in syrup form or in grain form. So as a sweetener, it's actually available, as a common product. As an ingredient in foods, I think maybe there's only three, maybe four, companies that are using it as a sweetener or a flavoring agent.
It's really amazing to me. And it's amazing to me from the standpoint of you would think that more companies who produce products that have to be sweet. Okay, here we go. Soda. You know, like, why wouldn't the soda companies be? So it's got to be expensive, right?
It is. I mean, it's definitely more expensive than sugar or agave. Because it's not, you know, I think there's only one or two manufacturing outfits in the United States that actually carry it. So there's not a tremendous ability to source it the same way that you could, like, say, agave or, you know, a salsafame or something like that.
Right.
But it's sort of worth the headache on the cost side because it has so many properties. Which actually help when it comes to sweetening and flavoring, again, without having that big metabolic impact that a regular sugar would, or the less favorable taste impact that some of the other natural sweeteners might have for certain people's palates. So it's really nice in that regard. And again, you know, using allulose as a sweetener or an additive brings up the conversation that we were having prior to, right? And this really gets into, I think, the nuts and bolts of using nutrition effectively, which is everyone knows that, hey, nutrition can be powerful. For example, you know, it's starting to become more and more part of the popular consciousness that for diabetics who pursue a lower carb or low carb or even ketogenic diet, that they can relinquish in time their reliance on insulin, right? The tough part of that trajectory, of course, is staying compliant to a nutritional protocol, right? I don't think it's too controversial to say that pizza and beer and ice cream are pretty delicious. So, you know, being able to pursue a structured eating program where you're still able to have the taste profiles that you want, in other words, sweet things, you know, opens the door for something like allulose being an incredibly useful tool. Right? You can put it in your coffee. You can, you know, sprinkle it, on top of, any number of foods to enhance flavor and add sweetness.
Right.
These are big deals for people who are using nutrition as a metabolic intervention against disease or are trying to, you know, pursue the classic thing that you and I talk about, which is how do I put on muscle and remain lean concurrently? Well, you know, controlling blood sugar and controlling insulin is a big part of that, and allulose has a role to play there as well.
Where does allulose fit into the ketogenic diet? So there are a lot of people out there who, and especially like people like Andrew Scarborough, who he even stays away from stevia. Because there seems to be a consensus out there of people who believe that insulin signaling begins at the tongue. So as soon as you taste something sweet, the body starts to rev up in expectation of this sweet carbohydrate coming downstream. So where does it fit into the ketogenic diet? Is there any evidence that stevia is perfect for those who are keto and want to taste something sweet, or can it interrupt the process of becoming keto adapted?
Sure. I mean, probably the best way to understand that is to measure insulin response and also breath hydrogen response, because that tells you something very specific about what's happening metabolically. And the good news is that we've had an opportunity to look at that through our partners at ASPI. You mentioned him earlier, Dr. Jacob Wilson over at the Applied Science and Performance Institute. And those guys have done a very good job at not only looking at fibers, but also looking at allulose and seeing what the metabolic response is. And it's effectively zero. And that's not to say that there couldn't be other cofactors in that. I mean, obviously much, much more work has to be done. But the preliminary results are, you know, fairly compelling in terms of describing that, hey, when you consume allulose as a sweetener, whether as a standalone or as a, as an ingredient in a food, there really is no metabolic response. Now, if you're combining that with a higher glycemic carb, obviously that's a different story, and you'd have to take that into account.
Any negatives, any drawbacks, anything that you could say on the other hand about allulose?
Sure. I mean, as I mentioned before, it's about 80% as sweet or 80% or so sweet as sugar. So it's a very, very close analog to the sugar taste, but it's not an absolute facsimile of it. And so that is something, you know, for people who are looking for a very specific culinary outcome, it may not fit the bill in all instances. But I would say in most instances, it really and truly does. And for people who are wanting to eat lower carb, you know, particularly if they're baking, you know, if a recipe calls for 2 cups of sugar, it might be a cup and a half of allulose and a half a cup of sugar.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there you're lowering the profile of metabolic impact.
Right.
So there's a lot of different uses, right? I mean, and you brought up a great point about our friend Andrew Scarborough. You know, when you're dealing with a brain cancer model, the standard of rigor for what's consumed may be astronomically high in comparison to other diseases or other disease states, and may be different from what people are trying to achieve from a performance perspective. And it's actually worth noting, because I think in a lot of these discussions, sometimes these constituents are presented sort of like as silver bullets. Works
right.
In every case, does everything you want. And as compelling as allulose is, I think there, you know, we could come up with cases where another choice might be preferable. So it has, I think, a pretty wide spectrum of use, but may not give you everything you want in every instance.
So we've learned that the lactose in breast milk is more so there to, mm-hmm. I'm sorry, the IMO in breast milk, I think it is. I may be wrong about this, but there's some component of carbohydrate in breast milk that's just there to feed microbes. We've discovered now it's the baby doesn't get anything out of it. The baby's microbes do, and the microbes that ride along in the breast milk. What happens with allulose and say a soluble corn fiber in the gut? Any magic there? Anything at all?
Well, yeah. I mean, they both contribute towards the same insulin mediating effect, right? And that was actually something that Dr. Wilson discovered. Carl, I'm seeing that my laptop is losing power.
Okay.
Let's
go to a break. We're going to go to a break. We'll take a quick break and plug in and do what you got to do. All right. Sit tight. We'll be right back with more, Superhuman Radio.
Quest Keto is making the ketogenic lifestyle more delicious and more convenient than ever. The high-fat, moderate-protein, low-carb keto diet has earned a reputation for being complicated. Quest Keto has changed all of that by offering sweet and savory snacks and an entire line of ready-to-go ketogenic meals. They've taken the guesswork out of it for you. From keto cinnamon rolls, pizza, crackers, and more, you can enjoy it all and experience the benefits of this nutritious approach anytime, anywhere. Thanks to Quest Keto. Go to QuestKeto.com to order your meals today.
There are a few products that I believe in the way I believe in CanSee eye drops. I've been using CanSee for 6 months now, and the changes in my vision are nothing short of amazing.
Wow, that's an old commercial. The truth is I've been using CanSee eye drops for 11 years now, and I credit CanSee eye drops as being the reason that I do not need reading glasses at 58 years old. CanSee eye drops improves the quality and health of your eyes indefinitely. That's why I both use and endorse CanSee Eye Drops, go to wisechoicemedicine.com and learn about how CanSee Eye Drops can improve the health of your eyes and the quality of your vision today.
New Mass Pro Synthogen X2 just upped its own legendary game. To distance itself even further from the rest of the pack, Synthogen X2 now has double the key active ingredients. If you've ever wondered what steroid-like recovery feels like, Synthogen X2 delivers. See why others compare it favorably to powerful bodybuilding drugs at Synthogen.com. Mass Pro Synthogen. When you train with it, you'll gain with it. Alaskans agree that sockeye offers the truest salmon taste. Over decades of fishing Alaskan waters, Vital Choice has rare access to the very finest of these fish. Vital Choice sockeye comes from smaller harvest regions with fewer boats and faster processing. So our sockeye is flash frozen within hours of harvest to capture its fresh caught quality. Rich in flavor, omega-3s, and vitamin D, our most popular salmon also abounds in astaxanthin, the potent antioxidant that provides its vibrant red hue. Save 15% off. Go to Superhuman Radio and click the Vital Choice banner ad today.
If you followed my transformation on Facebook, you've been wondering what I've done to create such dramatic results. One of the things is I've started every day with the Ketogenics Prime and then trained fasted and remained fasted till my first meal at 2 o'clock. Ketogenics Prime gives me all the energy I need while shutting down hunger. And since the ketones are bound to a quad mineral blend, I'm getting all the magnesium, calcium, potassium, and sodium I need to keep my minerals in balance. Try Ketogenics Prime yourself. Go to superhumanradio.com and click the Ketogenics banner ad today and save 25% off your first purchase. Ketogenics Prime. I couldn't have done it without it.
Mitochondrial uncoupling is the holy grail of fat loss. Making mitochondria work harder raises body temperature and metabolic rate without the jitters of stimulants. Now there is an over-the-counter mitochondrial uncoupler that will let you shred your body down to the last pounds of body fat. It's Trojan Horse. This is the supplement breakthrough of the decade. Go to superhumanradio.com and click the Trojan Horse banner ad. Use coupon code SHR and save 20% off your order today. BlackstoneLabs.com. Trojan Horse. 4.6 million years of evolution gave us the blueprint for the perfect protein supplement for humans. So why do all protein supplement manufacturers ignore it? We don't. The first human-appropriate protein supplement is Thrive Advanced. Built around the blueprint of mother's milk, Thrive Advanced contains the amino acids, peptides, micronutrients, enzymes, probiotics, and vitamins that support protein absorption and assimilation. All of our dairy proteins come from happy cows on pastures here in the United States and are low-heat pasteurized. You'll never find any artificial sweeteners, additives, or ingredients. You won't even find thickeners or gums in Thrive Advanced. And we back up our label claims with post-production lab analysis that's available right on our website. Visit superhumanradio.com and click the Thrive Advance banner ad and use code SHR and save 50% off your entire order today.
You're listening to the Superhuman Channel. We're ripped and we're ready.
Welcome back. Emergency averted. We have to give a shout out to Victoria Dellis because she is a key player at the Epigenics Foundation, I know. So we want to acknowledge that.
Indeed, that's accurate. Yep.
We also want to say that if you share this Facebook Live, you're automatically entered to win $100 worth of free product from Keto Sports or Prototype Nutrition. Pass this around. People need to hear this. It's astonishing to me. The number of people who still don't understand the metabolic origins of many of their diseases. And quite frankly, when you talk to them about the sort of stuff, they just don't believe it. So we have to, the genetic origins of every disease message is being blasted from a million points every single day. And then there's those of us who say, no, you know, what you eat has a lot to do with it. So we have to gain more momentum and more gravity in this message in order to have some sort of an effect. So pass this around. Okay, so we were talking about how the soluble corn fiber and the allulose work synergistically to keep insulin levels down. But is there any interaction? Does allulose have any benefit when taken with fiber, for instance? Is there any magic going on in the gut? Do we know any of that yet?
Not yet. I mean, whether or not there's a synergistic effect is something that, we still have to ascertain, but we do have an understanding that they both contribute towards that same insulin-mediating effect, and we gain that understanding from testing those constituents individually and watching or observing insulin response. But you bring up a great point, which is, you know, more broadly, how can combining macronutrients, whether it's a fiber, a protein, carb or fat, how can we combine macronutrients to get a given metabolic outcome? And, you know, the good news is this work has actually been done. It's in the literature. It's just really not part of the popular consciousness. And so, for example, what's interesting is if you look at a dose response curve comparing macronutrients, you get a very different picture. So, for example, if you offer somebody a carbohydrate in a fasted state, you sort of get this spike and this drop off, right? I think people understand this, particularly if they've looked at the glycemic load, for various carbs. Where the picture starts to get more nuanced and more interesting is if you feed someone a protein in a fasted state, you get a little bit less of a spike. In some instances, significantly less, depending on how many calories of that protein have been offered. But when you feed a fiber or a fat, it's literally a flat response. And so that's where, you know, you start to see the power of a ketogenic diet, or a low carb, or controlled carb diet. And when you start combining fibers and fats, and, you know, sweeteners like say an allulose, which doesn't have a metabolic impact, you start to see that you have a way of essentially deciding in advance what you want your metabolism to do. And, you know, you brought up the genetics. You know, I think everyone can understand that genetics are important. But there's a less or less of an appreciation for epigenetics,
yes.
Right? In other words, how the environment, or even more importantly, how the choices you make impact health outcomes, right? And you know, sometimes it's an easy way to talk about this is to say, hey, look, genetics are the hand of cards that you got dealt, but epigenetics is how you play that hand.
Right.
Right. And you know, the choices that you make when it comes to food consumption, the choices that you make in terms of what you expose yourself to in the environment can have a dramatic impact on health outcomes. And I think at least when it comes to disease, particularly cardiac disease, diabetes, cognitive decline, you know, like Alzheimer's disease, cancer, there's a growing appreciation for the epigenetic impact that can influence the expression of those diseases, right? I mean, particularly in the case of cancer, people sort of, or say, for example, Alzheimer's. In Alzheimer's, if you are predisposed to an APOE4 gene, or in cancer, if you're predisposed to a BRCA gene, right, that definitely increases your risk profile.
Yes.
There's very good metrics, very good studies on that,
yes.
Right? The question becomes, for a given individual, will that predisposition actually be expressed based on the choices that you make?
And twin studies,
twin
studies, they reveal the answer. When we look at twin studies where twins were either separated at birth or they led completely different lifestyles and they had genetic predispositions to diseases and one gets it and one doesn't, that shoots the whole genetic absolute discussion down. The way I have learned to discuss genetics, because sometimes you can have greater impact when you use the absurd, right? So I like to say, you know, if I'm out swimming with Daniel and I decide I'm going to go down and breathe water, I will drown. Does that mean I am genetically predisposed not to breathe water? Yes, I am genetically predisposed not to breathe water. I'm not a fish. You know, people always say, well, my mother had breast cancer, my sister had breast cancer, and I'm going to have breast cancer. Well, the other thing that you got besides your genetics from your mom is your lifestyle, how you eat, how important sleep is to you, how important exercise is to you. So that's the thing you can change. You may not be able to change the genes that you were given, as you point out, But the things that you have the ability to change can have greater impact on your outcome. So, and again, this is another discussion that must be repeated over and over again in order for us to develop the same gravity that the mainstream medical orthodoxy is putting on the importance of genetics. Look at the money. And I'm saying this, not you. Look at the money that's been wasted on cancer research because of strictly looking at genetics. Look at the money that's been wasted on Parkinson's disease research because of strictly looking at genetics. We have to stop that. We have to start to work with what we have control over. We may not be able to change your genetics, but we can change the way you eat. We can change. You know, Dr. Dale Bredesen, who's at UCLA, was on my show in 2013, and he reversed Alzheimer's symptoms. He can't say reversed Alzheimer's because they couldn't biopsy these brains, but he said he reversed the symptoms in 26 people. He's doing a 200-patient multi-centered study now, and I've already communicated with him. He's having similar results with these people. And what did he change? He changed what they eat, changed when they eat. He started to use a more ancestral meal frequency pattern, which we like to call intermittent fasting. Stop eating at 6, go to bed at 9. He started to do things to improve their sleep hygiene. He put them on hormone replacement therapy. He got them taking certain vitamins, minerals, and nutrients. And he reversed the symptoms of Alzheimer's disease. The reason I say that is because whenever you hear something on TV about Alzheimer's disease, it's always followed with, of which there is no cure. Alzheimer's disease, of which there is no cure. That's just not true. That's just not, there may not be a pharmaceutical cure for it, but there is a cure for it, and it's lifestyle.
Yeah, I mean, what you're speaking to is actually pretty interesting, and there's a very recent example that sort of follows in the footsteps of what you're describing, and I believe that the data will come out, I think, later this year, and what I'm referring to is the large cohort study that Dr. Sarah Halberg and Dr. Jeff Volek are doing. Yeah. With diabetic patients, whereby they are feeding them a very low carb or ketogenic meal program and getting these diabetic patients off their insulin in fairly short order. I think this will be, once the data comes out on this, this will be a pretty, you know, significant brick in the wall, which illustrates in practical terms not only the power of nutrition, but this idea that genetic predisposition doesn't describe every circumstance and disease that we might think it does currently. And actually some of this work has been done in the past. Dr. Peterson, in fact, there's a great synopsis of his work in Travis Christofferson's Tripping Over the Truth book. He did a very interesting experiment back in the 70s, which really challenges the idea of the somatic theory of cancer, or the genetically predisposed theory of cancer, whereby what he did was he took the nucleus of a tumor cell, I believe it was a lung tissue tumor cell, and transplanted that into a healthy cell. But there was no consequence, nothing happened. But when he took the mitochondria,
right,
of the tumor cell and put it in the healthy cell, that healthy cell, in fact, turned cancerous. Now, I don't know if that experiment has been replicated in modern times, but it really does offer an alternative explanation as to what drives disease. In other words, the disease at least is heavily, heavily influenced by cellular metabolism.
And Dr. Seyfried, in his book, alludes to that phenomenon when he shows that the genetic transcription changes happen after the mitochondria shifts to anaerobic respiration, not before. So
yeah, and you're right. And that really challenges this idea of oncogenes as they're currently characterized,
yes,
right? They didn't really and truly exist. But he's digging into that chicken and the egg question, which is, you know, what comes first? And that's actually really fascinating. And I think that, you know, you mentioned where the dollars get applied in research. There's some light at the end of that tunnel. You know, traditionally, NIH and other funding agencies, you know, don't put a lot of resources into metabolic approaches to disease, or let alone nutritional studies, partly because they are tough to run. Keeping hundreds of people compliant on a diet, mm-hmm, is a lot tougher than keeping them compliant to taking a drug. that is starting to change. If one does a search of clinicaltrials.gov, you can see that there's been an explosion in people posting studies that look at nutrition and disease, in particular that look at the effects of the ketogenic diet on a whole landscape of diseases. You know, obviously seizure and epilepsy, of course, that's been its traditional domain. Obviously now cancer, but most interestingly in the arena of cognitive decline. And that goes back to what you were speaking to earlier, which is, can we use nutrition to check the advancement of diseases like Alzheimer's and dementia, or in fact reverse them once they've presented?
So I'm going to forego our last commercial break because the discussion is so intriguing. I want to discuss protein for a second.
Okay.
I think it was when I was out at Quest one time that Ron Penna had suggested to me that the body is looking for a certain amount of protein, and that may be why people who eat a lot of carbs overeat them, because the body's going, I'm not done getting my protein yet, and it doesn't care that it's riding along with a bolus of carbohydrates. And with the new fixation on the ketogenic diet being high fat, moderate protein, low carb, and when we talk about the ketogenic diet, we have to be careful because there's therapeutic templates, and then there's more of a sports nutritionist template that seems to be more lenient about the protein consumption. But what is your opinion of a low carb diet that is in fact high in protein and at the same time high in fat? There are many out there who argue that the protein will be converted through gluconeogenesis into glucose. So you're really shooting yourself in the foot. Are you really shooting yourself in the foot? Where do you stand on the more lenient, in a higher protein form of, for lack of better terms, a ketogenic diet?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, here you bring up probably where the most interesting conversation is to be had, because there's a lot of cofactors which introduce nuance into the model that you've described, right? So, for example, if you're describing a sedentary person who is consuming that macronutrient profile, in other words, low carb, high protein, perhaps modest or higher fats, then you're right. There may be tremendous gluconeogenesis conversion of those proteins into carbs. Maybe less so than if carbohydrate was higher, but certainly some. However, if you're describing a person that is, an Olympic athlete, you may see a very, very different nutrient partitioning effect. So I think it's important to recognize that physical exertion is such a key cofactor in all of this. And then also, you know, that individual's metabolism, right? Some people are predisposed to synthesize protein at higher and more efficient rates than others. And that depends on any number of other cofactors like supplementation. So those are some of the things that I think you have to add into that picture. The overarching component of that, which to me is interesting, is, you know, there's a lot of people out there who have a pretty good understanding of the benefits of carb cycling, right? In other words,
right,
they want to incur the performance effect of carbs, but they also want to limit and control that consumption so that they can stay lean, right? This is a well-understood phenomenon, say, in physique competitions or bodybuilding, right? I think there's starting to be an appreciation for the ability to get a very similar effect and perhaps an even more favorable effect by fat cycling, right? In other words, by replacing your primary energy source from carb to fat and essentially going through an interval where fats are high and fats are low can be very, very advantageous. And while keeping protein high, that allows you to retain muscle mass or perhaps even stimulate the growth of new muscle mass.
Right.
So I think there's a growing appreciation for how these manipulations can be used to get the performance effect that one wants with these macronutrients.
Now, I know that you tend to be a flexible ketogenic dieter. You'll go in and out. I know also Shannon Yorton Penna is another one of, you know, she'll go full on keto for a while, but then she'll increase her protein and then she'll even have her carbs. And so, which I think is a much more appropriate way to do it and probably emulates a more ancestral, pattern of ketogenesis as opposed to this year round staying in keto thing. So yeah. With that being said, I also know that you box. You do these seal fit things, you and Josh Field. I've heard you mention a dietary sugar that I think you use in and around your workout called cluster dextrin.
Cluster dextrin is probably, you know, in fact, I'm glad you brought up Josh's name because he's the guy that really schooled me on this. And once I started using it, I found, wow, you know, this might be one thing that approaches being a silver bullet. And what I mean by that is if someone's pursuing a ketogenic diet, right, and they're being very consistent about measuring their daily blood glucose and daily blood ketones, perhaps multiple times a day, because their goal is to remain in ketosis for a period of time, you know, it can be the case that you take a performance hit. For a couple of reasons. One, you may not have the carbs, which, you know, carbs are phenomenal for performance. But two, if you're controlling calories, you may feel satiated, but you may not have those energy reserves that you want. And all cluster dextrin is a highly branched carbohydrate. And what's great about it is by consuming it, you get all the performance benefits of a carb. In other words, if you go to the gym and you're doing a bodybuilding or powerlifting style workout, you will get those big pumps. But it doesn't impact insulin. In other words, there's no insulin response when you consume it. And so this is kind of one of those supplements that for people who are using a ketogenic diet but also need the benefits of performance from carbohydrates, cluster dextrin really and truly does fit the bill for that because it allows you to remain in ketosis while getting a performance benefit.
You used the word impact just now, which reminded me of a question I did want to ask you about allulose, and we can finish the discussion on this. So we are all, you know, labels love to say, you know, only three net carbs or three impact carbs, right? Where does allulose fall into that? Do you have to claim it as a full sugar if you use a certain amount, or can you use the 0.2 figure to come up with like a net carb or net impact of carbs?
Right. You know, that you actually bring up a great point, and it's probably one of the reasons why allulose isn't more appreciated.
Yeah.
Because there's a little bit of a steep learning curve, right? So because it is a sugar, despite its unique properties of, you know, having very low calories and no glycemic load or impact, it does have to be listed as a full sugar.
Right.
So oftentimes someone will look at the label and go, oh my God, 12 sugars or 15 sugars, I can't eat this product.
Right.
And so the calculation sort of has to be done offline to get a true understanding of not only what the accurate caloric density is, but an understanding of the constituent itself to know that, hey, I may be consuming X number of grams of allulose, but it won't impact my blood sugars. And the great news is, you know, this is actually a measurable phenomenon, right? Anyone can, you know, go on Amazon or go down to their CVS or their Walgreens, get a glucometer and, you know, consume that ingredient and see what happens. So these aren't things that are unknowable. Anyone can evaluate allulose for themselves.
Do you see some strategic wording working its way into labels of products that use allulose primarily as their sweetener to have something that says maybe you can't say impact or net carbs, but instead equal to, you know, 1 gram of sugar, or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, any product that uses it will typically have you know, a sentence or two, or maybe even a paragraph describing what's really going on.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I think it'll be slow going in the beginning because the consumers will have to catch up to that and sort of grasp what's going on with allulose. But I think that will happen. There's a growing appreciation for it, and I think we'll see eventually not only the consumer understand, but hopefully, and this is a slower burn, obviously, but that the FDA will begin to change its appreciation, not just for allulose as an ingredient, but more broadly, begin to change how nutrition facts are presented based on metabolic impact.
Yeah.
And I think that's a slower burn. It will take some time for that to happen, but that's actually really where it needs to go so that a consumer can understand, like, oh, okay, by reading this ingredient deck and by reading these nutrition facts, I can understand in advance what the metabolic consequences are of consuming this particular food.
Yeah, I like that. That would be great to have a 1 to 10 scale of metabolic impact for certain
right.
sweeteners, for instance. That yeah. would be very, very cool. Did we miss anything that you want to convey?
Well, you know, I tell you, man, I think this hour came fast.
Yeah.
There's probably a ton more topics that we could cover, but let's do a part two, my man.
Yeah, there you go. And if those of you watching and listening to the show, if you have questions for Daniel and you are listening after you're listening to the podcast or the recorded video, send questions to onair@superhumanradio.com. I'll forward them to Daniel. We'll have him back on.
Outstanding.
Thank you so much for being on the air today with me.
Indeed. Carl, thank you so much, man. This is great.
Talk to you soon. We're going to take that own mic off. We're going to take that cue as the end of the show. Thank you for listening and watching today, and we'll see you tomorrow.